Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
On our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with counselor, pastor, and author of the best-selling book, The Five Love Languages, Dr. Gary Chapman, about a new book he co-authored, Keeping Love Alive as Memories Fade. I'm excited. I bet you're excited.
I am so excited. The book, The Five Love Languages, is one that has been near and dear to me over the years, and I'm just delighted to get a chance to talk with him and then to learn more about how he's applying some of these concepts of investing in relationships, how he's applying those concepts to caring for loved ones with Alzheimer's.
Yeah, a lot of us have family members, friends, colleagues, patients that are suffering from dementia. This book is directly relevant. Very excited. But we also have research that's directly relevant. And let's dive right in with our very first research that matters about libraries and their utility for health. Do we have to just justify this?
Well, you know, I love this research because, you know, as we're moving into the modern age, one could argue that libraries are sort of old-fashioned or outmoded institutions, or that they maybe aren't relevant in the digital age. We, in our own building, we used to have a library with books and magazines, and now that's become, you know, space for a very important tobacco program that's near and dear to you. But here, the question is, you know, what in a big city or in other places, what role do libraries have in communities? What role do they have in caring for people related to health?
Yeah, this was actually an article that was in the journal Health Affairs, and it really suggests that libraries play a unique role in health for perhaps vulnerable populations. So people who are homeless, people who have serious mental illness, people who have substance abuse problems. These are not groups that you would think of, and certainly not, we wouldn't say, the main role of libraries, but as a source of information. But I found that really interesting.
Yeah, they looked at research related to 5.8 million in-person visits to Philadelphia libraries. They interviewed staffers and residents within the library locations and found that the librarians spent a lot of time helping with mental health and substance abuse issues, connecting people with resources. They helped provide a safe space for homeless people and helped with housing applications, and also were a safe place for recent immigrants and traumatized children and families who needed safe places to go and needed to be linked with community resources.
And then when you think about libraries in rural areas and the difficulty people who may have to access to reliable internet and information, we can understand how libraries have transformed themselves from places to check out books to places to get help. But also it suggests that our librarians are doing a lot of social work functions.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them don't have that sort of training. That may be something we need to work on.
Absolutely. Let's jump into our next research that matters, which is about constipation and kidney disease. We've gone from libraries and social work functions to the kidney and the bowel.
This is a serious problem here, both constipation and how frequent it's a problem in adults, and then also chronic kidney disease. So the question is, are these two issues related, and how might they be related? And this was a study that was in the Journal of the American Society of Nephrology.
So these scientists looked at about 360,000 cases of chronic kidney disease over 7 years. And of those, about 7,600 cases of kidney failure over the course happened. And people who had constipation had an average of 13% higher risk of kidney disease and a 9% increased risk in kidney failure, suggesting that there's some increased risk for kidney disorders if you have chronic constipation or a diagnosis of that, and that we don't quite understand what the link is, but maybe one is a risk factor for the other.
Yeah, and they also found the kidney function deteriorated faster in people with more severe constipation. This was looking at medical records of 3.5 million United States military veterans, all of whom had normal kidney function at the start of the research. But since 1 out of 10 people in the United States had some form of chronic kidney disease, this really is important. And one of the things they hypothesized there could be some microbiome kind of things going on in the gut. I also think, you know, if you have constipation, you have retention of urine a lot of times. You don't, until you relieve that constipation. So this urinary retention, a backup of the urine could actually impact adversely the kidneys. So
certainly more study is needed. But if there is a link here, then it will help us potentially target bowel transit and other forms of bowel health in order to try to prevent
good for anyone
constipation and prevent kidney disease.
We don't have to tell any of our listeners that. Our next research that matters is about the aorta and its rigidity in African Americans. And does that rigidity, the higher stiffness of that vessel, explain higher rates of hypertension and heart disease?
So this was a study that appears online in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, Cardiovascular Imaging. And they examined data from about 2,500 participants in the Dallas Heart Study, which is a multi-ethnic population-based cohort. So what they did was they looked and used different methods to assess the stiffness of the aorta, which is that big, large artery in the body that runs from the top of the left ventricle in the heart down to the abdomen. And it's a very important mediator of blood pressure. And they found indeed that African Americans have more rigidity of the aorta and compared with Caucasians and Hispanics, and that Hispanics had more rigid aortas than Caucasians.
And this seems to have perhaps explained some of the aspects that, along with higher sodium intake among African Americans and Hispanics, lower intake of potassium, perhaps some genetic differences in collagen, that may all contribute to, associated with the aortic stiffness. I don't think this is the type of research that directly translates immediate into what do we do next, but it helps start to explain, and perhaps it reemphasizes that we need to be aware of this rigidity and the higher risk that these vulnerable populations and minorities may face.
That's right. We know there are health disparities related to blood pressure, and particularly with poor outcomes for African Americans. So I think this is just another piece of the puzzle, but also a call out that if you are African American or Hispanic, you're at higher risk of complications from blood pressure, and you want to get your blood pressure checked, and also don't ignore it. Make sure you follow up with your doctor and tend to these things.
Good advice. Our last research that matters is about glaucoma and cataracts, two really common conditions. And after cataract surgery, actually the most common complication is developing high eye pressure, which can really be associated with and contribute to glaucoma. That could be a real problem. And how can we prevent glaucoma, high eye pressure from developing after cataract surgery, which is one of the most common surgeries in the country?
Well, and like anything else, we may not be able to prevent that high eye pressure from happening, but if we can detect it earlier and monitor it better, we may be able to intervene and mitigate the downward effects from that. So there is this new electronic eye pressure monitoring device known as a tonometer that is often used, but it's used in the clinical setting, in the outpatient setting, but not so often in the surgical setting. So they were able to study patients who had this eye pressure adjusted right after the cataract surgery to see if they can make a difference in reducing those outcomes over time.
It reminds me of Goldilocks. Was this bed too soft? Was this bed too hard? Was this bed just right? Did it have the right fairy tale here?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so.
So the way we traditionally look at eye pressure after cataract surgery is to put like a saltwater solution and tap on the eye with a Q-tip to find out if it's too firm, too soft, or just right. And I'm thinking, really?
With a Q-tip?
Yeah. And now they're suggesting let's just use the existing technology, this tonometer that can really accurately look at eye pressure. I think I'm at some risk because of family history of developing glaucoma. I'm sure I'll have cataract surgery sometime in my life. I want this tonometer used. I don't want the person taking a Q-tip and making that Goldilocks assessment.
All right. It does conclude the portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we have the great privilege of talking with counselor, pastor, and author of the best-selling book, The Five Love Languages, Dr. Gary Chapman, about his new book, Keeping Love Alive as Memories Fade, The Five Love Languages and the Alzheimer's Journey. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam, we have the great privilege of talking with counselor, pastor, and author of the best-selling book, The Five Love Languages, Dr. Gary Chapman, about his new book, Keeping Love Alive as Memories Fade, The Five Love Languages and the Alzheimer's Journey.
Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Chapman.
Well, thank you, Adam and Christy. It's good to be with you.
Well, it's great to be with you. We are so excited that we have you and your work that's influenced so many people, and I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk about it. I know Christy's just itching.
I am so excited to talk to you today because The Five Love Languages has been a book that has been commonly used in my church community and local community and has been a very powerful tool to help marriages and improve relationships over time. So I'm just grateful and excited to get to talk to you today.
Well, thank you, Christy. I'm very encouraged by the way that book has helped so many couples connect emotionally with each other on a deeper level by learning how to speak each other's love language.
Well, we are going to dive in, but I think our first thing we want to know is tell us how you came to become a pastor, a counselor, and then ultimately an author.
Well, you know, when I began to work on a church staff, and I've been on the same staff now for 45 years, I really never anticipated getting heavily involved in counseling. I had obviously taken a lot of counseling courses, but what I found is where people are really hurting is in marriage and family relationships. So I kind of got pushed into the counseling part, and it later became a major part of my life and my ministry. And the five love languages I really learned in the context of the counseling office. You know, a wife would say, you know, I just feel like he doesn't love me. And the husband would say, how can you say that? I do this and this and this, and I don't love you? So I heard similar stories over and over and over, and I knew there had to be a pattern to what I was hearing. So I took time to sit down and read 12 years of notes that I made when I was counseling people and ask myself the question, when someone said, I feel like my spouse doesn't love me, what did they want? What were they complaining about? And their answers fell into five categories, and I later called them the five love languages. And so I started using this in my counseling and helping couples discover each other's love language, and sometimes they would come back in 3 weeks and say, Gary, this is just changing everything. I mean, the whole climate's different now. Then I started using it in small groups, and the same thing happened. And eventually I thought, you know, if I could put this in a book and write it in the language of the common person, maybe I could help a lot of couples I would never have time to see in my office. So that's what motivated me to write the book, and that's how it all happened.
Well, we are so glad that you did. And I know we're going to move towards your new book and its application of the five love languages in the Alzheimer's journey. But for those listeners who maybe aren't familiar with the five love languages as part of their daily way of talking with their spouse, can you kind of outline briefly for us what those five love languages are?
Surely. One would be words of affirmation. You look nice in that outfit. Really appreciate what you did. Just using words to affirm the person. A second love language is acts of service, doing something for the other person that you know they would like for you to do. You remember the old saying, actions speak louder than words. It's true if this is your love language, if acts of service is your love language. Then there's gifts. It's universal to give gifts as an expression of love. The gift says, they were thinking about me. And then there's quality time. Giving the person your undivided attention, then physical touch. We've long known the emotional power of physical touch. That's why we pick up babies and hold them and kiss them and cuddle them. And long before the baby understands the meaning of the word love, the baby feels love by physical touch. So the basic concept is that each of us has a primary love language. One of these five speaks more deeply to us emotionally than the other four. And seldom does a husband and wife have the same love language. But we tend to speak our own language, and thus we can be sincere in expressions of love, the other person doesn't get it because we're speaking our language and not their language.
I'm going to make an assumption here that will be, I think, vital for us, our discussion of your new book, that learning can occur with these so that even if one is not one's primary, one can practice, one can get better. Is that assumption correct?
That's the good news, Adam, is that all of these can be learned. Yeah, you may not have received words of affirmation growing up, so it's not natural for you to speak words of affirmation, but you can learn how to speak each of these. I've sometimes said to husbands whose wives love languages as words, get you a sheet of paper, write down what you've heard other people say or what you maybe heard on TV or read in a newspaper, and then stand in front of the mirror, say these words out loud so you hear yourself saying them. Then walk into the room where your spouse is and say one of them, and then you can run. You know? And you broke the silence. And the second time is easier, and the third time is easier. So that's the good news. You can learn to speak these languages, and you will. If you genuinely love your spouse or anyone else, a child or anyone else, you will expend the effort to learn how to speak their language.
Well, that is exactly right. In the message of intentionally loving the people around us and investing in those relationships by speaking their language is just a really powerful one, and one that I know has held and repaired many marriages of those who've read your book. Now, as you've applied this into the Alzheimer's journey, tell us a little bit about what prompted you to then take this into a different form of life beyond marriage.
I tell you how this happened. I had an associate by the name of Debbie Barr, who was my assistant probably 30 years ago. In fact, she was probably my assistant even when I did the Love Language book, is now that I think about it. But she'd been gone for a long, long time. And she was working for Dr. Ed Shaw at the North Carolina Wake Forest Medical Center, and who had a program going, counseling program going for couples who were suffering with Alzheimer's. And she was typing his notes and realized that he was using the five love languages in helping these couples stay connected to each other. And so after a while, she simply said to him, you know, you and Dr. Chapman ought to get together and write a book on this. And turns out he was interested. She called me, and I said, well, if he's interested, he knows a lot more about it than I do. I'm certainly happy to join him and see what can be done. So that's what happened. That's how it happened. And, of course, my mother had suffered dementia. It never was diagnosed as Alzheimer's, but she had suffered dementia and gone through that. My wife's brother, who was a college professor, he just died this past year from the disease. So, you know, I'd had personal experience and encounters with it. But I began to sit in on some of the groups that he was doing in his counseling. He did some individual counseling, but he did group counseling. And listening primarily to the caregivers, who, for the most part, were partners, you know, or spouses of the person who had the disease. And I was intrigued, first of all, with the deep commitment that these spouses had to their spouse. And once they learned that they could communicate love emotionally to their spouse, even though the cognitive abilities were waning, they were just committed to it. And it was, to me, it was a very encouraging experience to work with Dr. Shaw and Debbie Barr on this project.
You start your book off with a poignant chapter about Ed and Rebecca. Is all writing personal?
You know, I think there is a sense in which that's true. I look at all of the books I've written through the years, and most of them have grown out of my own life and my counseling that I've done with other couples through the years. And I think Dr. Shaw probably would never have gotten involved in the disease if it were not that his wife came down with early onset Alzheimer's at the age of 53 or 54, as I remember. And he was, you know, the head of the department of oncology at the hospital. And he became so interested in the disease and in her that he resigned his position and went back to graduate school and did a master's in counseling, and then came back to the hospital and set up a memory counseling center in which he began to work with couples. So I think he would not have gotten involved in that had he not gone through that experience. And he sees that, and that's why we dedicated the book to Rebecca, his wife. Unfortunately, she died about a month before the book was released, but it's still a way of honoring her and the experience that he had with her.
What a powerful story. Dr. Chapman, we do need to take a short break. But guests, when we return, we will continue talking with counselor, pastor, and author of the best-selling book, The Five Love Languages, Dr. Gary Chapman, about his new book, Keeping Love Alive as Memories Fade, The Five Love Languages and the Alzheimer's Journey. We'll be right back with your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with counselor, pastor, and author, Dr. Gary Chapman, about his new book, Keeping Love Alive as Memories Fade, The Five Love Languages and the Alzheimer's Journey. Dr. Chapman, in your book, you all state that 100% of the couples that you've seen for dementia counseling have some sort of emotional disconnect from each other. Why is that true about this particular disease? And how did you begin to understand that there was a unique niche role for your work with this disease?
Well, I think it is true that emotionally we begin to be disconnected as the disease progresses. And the things that give rise to that, it typically begins, at least in a lot of cases, it begins with people just repeating the same question over and over and over again, or the same statement. I was talking to a lady Saturday night, as a matter of fact. I'd gone to a 40th wedding anniversary, and she said, all day long he's been saying, now where are we going? Now where are we going? Now where are we going? She said, I must have responded to that 100 times. And after a while, let's face it, that can be annoying. But then even more deeply than that is the mistaken identity, where they may think that you're their brother instead of their husband.
Hmm.
Or, you know, any other relationship. So they get a little mistaken about who you are. And then, of course, it often comes to the place where they no longer know who you are. And Dr. Shaw shares that in the book when his wife, I think she was 59 now, so she was about 3 or 4 years into this, in which she looked at him and said, you know, I don't know who you are. He said, honey, we've been married for over 30 years. But, you know, it's devastating.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize that emotionally you're losing something. You're losing connection here. And then, obviously, sometimes there are delusions as well. About 70% of the time this happens. And that's when they think there's somebody strange, you know, in the house with them, or that people on TV have actually come to visit them, you know, those kind of things. Or there's paranoid delusions. Now, my mother had this. She would say, somebody is stealing my money, so I'm going to hide it. Well, of course, she hid it, and she could never remember where she put it. But that things were happening that really weren't reality. And often in a relationship, a marriage relationship, the spouse may accuse the spouse of being unfaithful. You know, you're seeing somebody else. Or obsessive behavior, where they're, like, for example, watering flowers. I remember one husband was saying that his wife watered the flowers 16 times a day, you know, in the house, and the water's running on the floor. He said, I had to put the flowers in a bucket so that, you know, it wouldn't ruin the house. So those kind of things lead to emotionally feeling detached from each other. You realize you're losing the person, and it's step by step and day by day. But these are the factors that figure into that emotional distance between the two of you.
And now, you talked earlier in the first segment about the five love languages from your original book: acts of service, words of affirmation, physical touch, gifts, and quality time. Could you perhaps share some stories of people you've worked with who have used these love languages to make connections?
Well, you know, as I listened in the focus groups to these caregivers, these spouses, and listened to how what they were saying about how this was working for them, and of course, what we do and what we encourage is, as soon as the disease is diagnosed, if the two of you can discover each other's love language and start speaking it, you can really become pretty close, maybe even closer than you have been for a few years, while the person still has a lot of cognitive abilities. So we start there, But as the disease progresses, it becomes more and more difficult for the other person to respond. So you realize this is going to be a one-way street here. But I'm going to love them. I'm committed to them. And I'm going to find out ways to touch them emotionally. And what we've discovered, and of course research backs this up, that long after the cognitive memory, cognitive abilities are fading, the person can still feel love emotionally. You can still touch the mood system of the brain, the emotional system of the brain. And this is where the five love languages become helpful. It's not that their primary love language, when they were well, will necessarily speak to them throughout the whole process. But if you use these five as ways of kind of fishing for ways to touch them emotionally, you will touch them. They will feel loved. And you will see some response, even in the latter stages. I remember Dr. Shaw talked about his own wife, and he said gifts was really never her love language. But when he would give her an ice cream cone, she would say, mmm. Even after she wasn't talking, she wasn't able to communicate anything. But obviously, that was speaking deeply to her. My wife's brother, in the latter stages, he was at the place where he would just look at you. He wouldn't respond at all. You could talk, you could do anything. He would just look straight ahead. The last time she went to see him, which was 3 weeks before he died, she sat in front of him and she thought, I'm gonna try a little music here. So she sang You Are My Sunshine and a couple of other songs that she thought he might remember. No response. Then she sang, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. And when she did, he reached out with his hand and put his hand on her hand, and tears came to his eyes. She touched him deeply with that song. And, of course, music is a way to get right at the emotions of people. And of course, a lot of research has been done on that as well.
You have a chapter that's called Every Day is the Best Day.
Yeah.
I think for a lot of caregivers, it's really difficult. Each day is a difficult day because you relive the difficulty of someone who can't respond. How does that chapter help the caregivers?
Well, I think the title of that chapter is just stating reality, because with this disease, it's a downhill. It's not going uphill. It's going downhill. So if you realize that every day is the best day, this is the best day. It's going to be more difficult tomorrow. But where the love language helps is that when you have the sense that you can touch them emotionally, that you can create a mood inside of them, this gives you motivation to keep going, even as it gets more difficult day by day, because you are reaching out, you are using the different love languages, you are trying to touch them, and you are getting some kind of response typically when you do touch them emotionally. And for example, sometimes one of the characteristics of the disease is that people will be aggressive or agitated. But if you can touch them emotionally, often you see that agitation just diminish. And so it gives hope, even though things are getting worse and will get worse, it gives hope to the caregiver to know that even though it's one-sided now, I'm not receiving anything back from them, but I'm still loving them. I've got the ability, and I'm still loving them.
Wow, that is really a powerful and very hopeful message. As you look ahead and think about other health issues, I mean, I understand that this happened in your life, and both personally and professionally, and really tied those two concepts together. But I would imagine this isn't the only health issue you could apply the five love languages to. Have there been other topics that have come up in your work?
You know, Christy, we of course have four or five different applications. We have the five love languages of children, written to parents, helping them love children effectively, and the same thing with teenagers, because teenagers are different, as you know. And then we have a military edition, how this applies to military couples, and especially how it applies when you're deployed. How can you speak these languages and stay emotionally connected? But when it comes to other health issues, I think fundamentally we have to acknowledge, and I think almost everyone agrees to this, that the most fundamental emotional need we have is the need to feel loved by the significant people in our lives. And so if you're going through any disease, it's a time in which we really want to stay connected to that person. because if they feel love by the significant people in their lives, they're going to process the disease much, much better. Let's face it, it's a difficult thing when you're going through surgery or for this or that or the other thing. It's a difficult time for the person, but when they feel loved by you and you're there with them and they sense that, they're going to process whatever the physical problem is much better by feeling loved. So I think learning another person's love language can help you in all relationships, even in work relationships. You know, we have a book called The Five Languages of Appreciation in the Workplace, in which we're taking the love languages to work, but we're talking about appreciation rather than using the word love.
Well, we really appreciate you sharing your passion, your expertise, your thoughts, your words of advice with Your Health listeners. And while Christy doesn't have teens yet, I am so glad that she will get to experience her young children becoming teens, because we both know how much love there will be there. But for all of our listeners, we do want to encourage them to actually get a copy of this book. It's a life-changing book for, I think, populations and medical students and so many people who might be cared for or caring for those with memory disorders. And it's called Keeping Love Alive as Memories Fade, The Five Love Languages and the Alzheimer's Journey. Dr. Gary Chapman, thank you so much for being a guest on Your Health.
Well, thank you, Adam and Christy. It was good to be with you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Chapman, for your work and for the privilege today. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Christy and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, we want you to send your comments, send your questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd love to have our executive producer, Laura Lacey, read us our very first House Call question of the day.
I'm a 58-year-old woman, and over the last year or so, I've been having trouble sleeping. I fall asleep quickly, but I can't seem to sleep through the night. Is there anything I can do?
Well, you know, there are things that can be done. And I think the first thing to start with is to really understand this is happening over a longer period of time. So we would call it kind of chronic insomnia rather than, you know, just short term in relation to a stress. And there's some common sense things to say that you're having a hard time when you wake up going back to sleep, not falling asleep. So I think making that distinction there, I would first off find out, what are you doing before bed? What is your sleep hygiene in the routines? Because there may be some things that are not really good, like eating before you go to bed, having caffeine before you go to bed, having alcohol before you go to bed, things like that.
And also watching TV or having a lot, like the big light from your iPhone right in your face right before you go to sleep, which is, I've noticed to be something in my own
reading
life.
Reading about politics and the elections.
Oh my goodness,
was
don't
not
even get
really
us started.
Healthy for my sleep patterns.
Right. So depending on what factors may be contributing to your sleep problems, you would want to really work with your physician and tailor an approach based on what those factors are. We talked a little bit about sleep hygiene, just thinking about using your bed for sleeping and, you know, properly being in the dark and having it quiet and those kinds of things. But there can also be gains from making sure you're getting daily exercise and really working your body, both in stress reduction and making your body tired. There are also strategies through getting some behavioral therapy. We talk about CBT a lot, and sometimes people can get gains from that.
Cognitive behavior. So we understand how you're thinking about something leads to a behavior which may involve waking up. And a matter of fact, that's really recommended as the first line therapy before these medications that we oftentimes know that people are thinking about and want, because the medications work quickly, but they can produce dependence.
We wish you the best. Insomnia is such a challenge, and especially if it's going on this long, can really start to have some other effects in your life. So we want to encourage you to go see your physician and really try to tease out which different factors might be impacting your sleep and make a comprehensive plan to get you better.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
My 7-year-old is having trouble in school, and we're starting to worry that he might have a learning disability or ADD. What steps do we need to take to make sure he gets the help he needs?
Well, this is a difficult and a frequent issue because we know that attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, which could also be focused predominantly on the attention problem or the hyperactivity problem, people don't have to have both necessarily, is so common in the United States and among children. And there seems to be sometimes, I think, too much of a rush to go to medication quickly without really doing the diagnostic workup to make sure, is this what's going on? And then what else could it be?
And I know you want to go through some of the diagnostic criteria, Adam, but I just want to second how important it is to get the full evaluation of your child and not rush to that diagnosis. And that usually involves getting tests and surveys done by parents, by teachers, across multiple settings, and often an evaluation by a psychologist or a primary care physician to make sure that you do get the right diagnosis from these standard approaches.
And because ADHD can overlap with other developmental disorders, it's really important to make sure that you're not treating the right thing with the wrong drug or the wrong thing. You know, it can go both ways. And so you have to have at least six of the symptoms here. And I'm going to mention seven to them. We'll ask our great health sciences librarians to maybe put this up on our website. But the hyperactivity or inattention has to occur often, has to be present in more than one setting like school and home. Has to be there for at least 6 months. It has to be present before the age of 12. And by the way, these criteria can work down to the age of 4. It has to lead to some impairment of function. And this is where sometimes, you know, it may be there, but it's not leading to any impairment in function. So is that real or not? In the academic environment, maybe the social environment in the home, or if they're working in that sort of environment. And it has to be excessive for the development level of the child. A two-year-old is very active, and so we would have a harder time making that assessment in that circumstance.
And if it is ADHD, then or whatever the diagnosis, it's important to wrap the right services around the child. And so for ADHD, medications can be very, very helpful. Structure in the home and modifications at school in the classroom can make a big difference. And so there is great hope. As you know, this is a very common diagnosis right now. And it is important that you're doing just what you are, starting to recognize those problems and trying to take the right steps to make sure that you ensure your son gets all the help that he needs. We wish
you
all the best.
Great advice. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I have a visible scar from an accident that occurred about 18 months ago. I'd like to undergo plastic surgery to address it, but I'm not sure where to start. What do I need to know?
Well, thank you for the question. And this is not straightforward. We would like to say that you just go see a plastic surgeon and get that scar revision. We have to ask some other questions like, do you form big bad scars like keloids, or have you had a hypertrophic scar where that scar on the face perhaps is a little thicker than normal? This would influence the approach.
Sometimes there can be injections that can improve the appearance of the scar, or laser surgery, or sometimes a scar revision. There are multiple different approaches that a plastic surgeon or a dermatologist could help you with. Whether or not your insurance covers it would be another thing you'd want to know to figure out, you know, which treatment option really makes sense for you, also comparing the cost.
Just recognize that the insurance may cover it, may, if it impairs function. Not just quality of life, but function. So if you got a scar on that face, I might want to just know that it might impair your ability to open the eye or smile or something that's a functional, not just quality of life. That may help get it paid for. Well, that'll conclude the house calls today. We want to thank all of our listeners for joining us for Your Health Today. And if you have an issue you want us to address on an upcoming show, you can send it to us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
You can also visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes by getting our health app by searching Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. Our great guest today, Dr. Gary Chapman. And we hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.